This episode of Weird Darkness is dedicated to all of you who, despite the coronavirus quarantine and social distancing, are still putting your own health at risk to assist others who need supplies. Those of you working in grocery stores, restaurant drive-thrus, farmers who have no choice but to leave their homes in order to deliver produce, the Uber, DoorDash, and Grubhub drivers who take a chance every time they deliver an order to a stranger's house, to the pharmacists and technicians who are there to provide the medications we need during this terrifying time, to every single one of you who are stocking shelves, disinfecting services, and talking with people face-to-face to keep our lives moving forward, thank you. This episode is for you.
Stories and content in Weird Darkness can be disturbing for some listeners and is intended for mature audiences only. Parental discretion is strongly advised.
Welcome, Weirdos. I'm Darren Marlar, and this is Weird Darkness. Here you'll find stories of the paranormal, supernatural, legends, lore, crime, conspiracy, mysterious, macabre, unsolved, and unexplained. If you're new here, welcome to the podcast, and be sure to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. If you're already a weirdo, please share the podcast with others. Doing so helps make it possible for me to keep creating episodes as often as I do. This month marks 5 years of Weird Darkness, and I'm celebrating by raising funds and awareness about depression, which I'll tell you about later in the podcast, but I'd like to invite you to visit darknesschallenge.com now to learn more about it. That's darknesschallenge.com. Coming up in this episode, as I prepare for the Weird Darkness Halloween live stream this coming Saturday night, I thought it might be appropriate to bring back some of the stories I used during last year's live stream event, which were only heard by those who were watching the video at the time. I never released the audio of that night's live stream as a podcast episode. The audio from the video stream wasn't the greatest last year, so I've re-recorded these stories in my studio. These are not all the stories I used in last year's Halloween live stream, but many of the better ones, and I am saving one story from last year to use again this Saturday night for the 2020 Halloween live stream, as I like to use this story every year because I feel it's important to share on an annual basis. You'll have to watch the live stream this Saturday night to find out which story I'm talking about. While listening, be sure to check out the Weird Darkness website. At WeirdDarkness.com, you can sign up for the newsletter to win monthly prizes, which, by the way, I will be announcing my October winner later in this episode. You can find paranormal and horror audiobooks I've narrated, watch old horror movies for free, plus you can visit the Hope in the Darkness page if you're struggling with depression or dark thoughts. You can find all of that and more at WeirdDarkness.com. Now, bolt your doors, lock your windows, turn off your lights, and come with me into the Weird Darkness. Before we get into the darker stories of the evening, let's begin with something a bit lighthearted, but still appropriate for the Halloween occasion. It's hard to imagine today that Halloween and trick-or-treating were not always a huge part of American culture. For all my life, this has been a time of costumes, door-knocking, and candy. If you're my age, you might even remember the plastic costumes that you bought from Woolworths that tied behind your head and came with a mask that you slipped over your face and secured with a nylon cord. It was hard to see, almost impossible to breathe, and the cord usually snapped at some point during the night. But for one evening in the early 1970s, you were Batman, the creature from the Black Lagoon, or maybe one of the Planet of the Apes characters. Well, during my childhood, it seemed that trick-or-treating had been around forever, but it hadn't. It didn't make its way to America until the late 1920s, and within less than two decades, the tradition almost ended for good. It would take candy companies and a gang of cartoon kids to resurrect trick-or-treating after World War II and make it what it is today. World War II not only brought devastation to the entire globe, but it also affected the goods and services available on the home front. In an effort to alleviate price hikes and hoarding, the Office of Price Administration printed war ration books with stamps that were used in exchange for goods. Thanks to the fact that as much as a third of the sugar imported to the United States came from Japanese-occupied Philippines, sugar was the first consumer commodity to be rationed. War Ration Book No. 1, nicknamed the Sugar Book, was distributed starting on May 4, 1942, with deep cuts to sugar allowances. Children's Halloween celebrations had to be drastically altered. Sugar rationing came to an end in June 1947, and by the fall, the commercialization of Halloween started kicking off in ways that it never had in the 1920s. Candy companies like Curtis and Brock wasted no time in launching Halloween advertising campaigns, but they weren't the only ones. Children's magazines like Jack and Jill and Children's Activities both featured trick-or-treating in their October issues. Parents who only dimly recalled their own Halloween traditions began reviving the fun for their own children. Costume parties became all the rage, along with hayrides, bobbing for apples, midnight spook shows, and spooky attractions. But it was the iconic comic strip Peanuts that really captured the imagination of American children. In October 1951, creator Charles Schulz ran the first of his Halloween-themed strips. The characters made their first appearance in ghost costumes, prepared for Halloween ghosting. Patty even used Charlie Brown as the model for her jack-o'-lantern carving. These comic strips helped spread the popularity of Halloween. In 1966, a TV special, It's the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown, began its long run as a Halloween tradition. The short was nominated for 3 Emmy Awards and made such an impression on America's kids that after it aired, children from all over the country sent candy to Charlie Brown out of sympathy. With the trick-or-treating tradition firmly established, it began growing in size. In addition to televisions and magazines, schools began reinforcing the tradition when the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund, UNICEF, launched a national campaign to raise money for children. They handed out cardboard boxes for kids to take with them while trick-or-treating, and it turned out to be an effective campaign, raising more than $175 million in the U.S. alone. So when you take the kids out to collect candy this coming Saturday night, just remember how close we came to losing this tradition, and take a few minutes to sit down with Charlie Brown again this year. You won't be sorry you did. Before we knew October 31st as Halloween, before we knew it as All Hallows' Eve, it was known as Samhain, and still is in some cultures. Up next, we'll look at the origins of Halloween, of jack-o'-lanterns, and witches when Weird Darkness returns. So a lot of you have sent emails or left reviews saying, "Weird Darkness scared the crap out of me." Well, when that happens, I'd like to recommend Real Paper. Real Paper is toilet paper. It's what I use myself, in fact. It's both soft and sturdy, which you want in a toilet paper, but it's also environmentally green because no trees are cut down to make it. It's made from 100% bamboo, which is softer than other woods, meaning softer paper too, and it regrows without being replanted. They deliver it right to your door, and every roll of Real Paper you buy also helps to fund access to clean toilets for those in need, so you can feel good on the inside about cleaning your outside. You can try Real Paper right now by visiting realpaper.com. Real is spelled R-E-E-L, realpaper.com. And then use the promo code WEIRD and you'll get 25% off your first order. That's Real, R-E-E-L, realpaper.com, and get 25% off your first order of toilet paper if you use the promo code WEIRD. A quick program note, this coming Friday, October 30th, I'm bringing back my annual airing of Orson Welles' War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells. It was originally broadcast on another October 30th, back in 1938, and it is still one of my favorite pieces of radio theater. I remember hearing just a snippet of it when I was not even a teenager, and I was instantly mesmerized. It was probably the earliest influence of my journey towards eventually creating Weird Darkness. If you've never heard this Halloween time radio classic, you don't want to miss it. And if you've already heard it, well, you know it's worth hearing again and again. That's this coming Friday, October 30th, here on Weird Darkness. Halloween is the season for little ghosts and goblins to take to the streets, asking for candy and scaring one another silly. Spooky stories are told around fires, scary movies appear in theaters, and pumpkins are expertly and not so expertly carved into jack-o'-lanterns. Recently, creepy clowns seem to be doing some real terrorizing. In August of 2016, locals in Greenville, South Carolina reported a clown who was allegedly trying to lure children into the woods. Then in September, a teen reported a knife-wielding clown in Summitville, Tennessee. Local and state officials in many areas urged people to report suspicious clown sightings. And in South Florida, some stores pulled clown costumes from their shelves, and Broward County Police advised people not to dress up as the masked grinners, according to the Miami Herald. In 2017, the clowning continued. A movie based on the classic Stephen King story, It, was remade and released in the United States on September 8th. In the movie, a demon that takes the form of a clown lures children into the sewer with a red balloon. In Lititz, Pennsylvania, police responded to reports of over 20 red balloons tied to sewer grates, according to CBS News. People dressing as clowns remain a popular way to scare. Children in North Dakota, for example, were recently targeted by a knife-wielding clown with a boa constrictor, and in Australia saw an increase of clown sightings just before Halloween. Amid the silly and scary antics, Halloween is much more than just costumes and candy. In fact, the holiday has a rich and interesting history. Halloween, also known as All Hallows' Eve, can be traced back about 2,000 years to a pre-Christian Celtic festival held around November 1st called Samhain, which means summer's end in Gaelic, according to the Indo-European etymological dictionaries. Because ancient records are sparse and fragmentary, the exact nature of Samhain is not fully understood, but it was an annual communal meeting at the end of the harvest year, a time to gather resources for the winter months and bring animals back from the pastures. Samhain is also thought to have been a time of communing with the dead, according to folklorist John Santino. There was a belief that it was a day when spirits of the dead would cross over into the other world, Santino told Live Science. Such moments of transition in the year have always been thought to be special and supernatural, he added. Halloween provides a safe way to play with the concept of death. People dress up as the living dead, and fake gravestones adorn front lawns, activities that wouldn't be tolerated at other times of the year. But according to Nicholas Rogers, a history professor at York University in Toronto and author of the book Halloween From Pagan Ritual to Party Night, Oxford University Press, 2003, there's no hard evidence that Samhain was specifically devoted to the dead or to ancestor worship. According to the ancient sagas, Samhain was the time when tribal peoples paid tribute to their conquerors and when the ancient mounds might reveal the magnificent palaces of the gods of the underworld. Samhain was less about death or evil than about the changing of seasons and preparing for the dormancy and rebirth of nature as summer turned to winter. Though a direct connection between Halloween and Samhain has never been proven, many scholars believe that because All Saints' Day, or All Hallows' Mass, celebrated on November 1st, and Samhain are so close together on the calendar that they influenced each other and later combined into the celebration now called Halloween. the tradition of dressing in costumes and trick-or-treating may go back to the practice of mumming and guising, in which people would disguise themselves and go door-to-door asking for food. Early costumes were usually disguises, often woven out of straw, and sometimes people wore costumes to perform in plays or skits. The practice may also be related to the medieval custom of souling in Britain and Ireland when poor people would knock on doors on Hallowmas, which is November 1st, asking for food in exchange for prayers for the dead. Trick-or-treating didn't start in the United States until World War II, but American kids were known to go out on Thanksgiving and ask for food, a practice known as Thanksgiving begging. Mass solicitation rituals are pretty common and are usually associated with winter holidays, Santino said. While one tradition didn't necessarily cause the others, they were similar and parallel. These days, the trick part of the phrase trick or treat is mostly an empty threat. But pranks have long been a part of the holiday. By the late 1800s, the tradition of playing tricks on Halloween was well established. In the United States and Canada, the pranks included tipping over outhouses, opening farmers' gates, and egging houses. But by the 1920s and 30s, the celebrations more closely resembled an unruly block party, and the acts of vandalism got more serious. Some people believed that because pranking was starting to get dangerous and out of hand, parents and town leaders began to encourage dressing up and trick-or-treating as a safe alternative to doing pranks. However, Halloween was as much a time for festivities and games as it was for playing tricks or asking for treats. Apples are associated with Halloween, both as a treat and in the game of bobbing for apples, a game that since the colonial era in America was used for fortune-telling. Legend has it that the first person to pluck an apple from the water-filled bucket without using his or her hands would be the first to marry, according to the book Halloween and Commemorations of the Dead by Roseanne Montillo. Apples were also part of another form of marriage prophecy. According to legend, on Halloween, sometimes at the stroke of midnight, young women would peel an apple into one continuous strip and throw it over her shoulder. The apple skin would supposedly land in the shape of the first letter of her future husband's name. Another Halloween ritual involved looking in a mirror at midnight by candlelight for a future husband's face was said to appear. A scary variation of this later became the Bloody Mary ritual familiar to many schoolgirls. Like many such childhood games, it was likely done in fun, though at least some people did take it seriously. Some evangelical Christians have expressed concern that Halloween is somehow satanic because of its roots in pagan ritual. However, ancient Celts did not worship anything resembling the Christian devil and had no concept of it. In fact, the Samhain festival had long since vanished by the time the Catholic Church began persecuting witches in its search for satanic cabals. And of course, black cats do not need to have any association with witchcraft to be considered evil. Simply crossing their path is considered bad luck any time of the year. As for modern Halloween, Santino, writing in American Folklore, an encyclopedia, noted that Halloween beliefs and customs were brought to North America with the earliest Irish immigrants, then by the great waves of Irish immigrants fleeing the famines of the first half of the 19th century. Known in the North American continent since colonial days, by the middle of the 20th century, Halloween had become largely a children's holiday. Since that time, the holiday's popularity increased dramatically as adults. Communities and institutions, such as schools, campuses, and commercial haunted houses, have embraced the event. Through the ages, various supernatural entities, including fairies and witches, came to be associated with Halloween. And more than a century ago, in Ireland, the event was said to be a time when spirits of the dead could return to their old haunting grounds. Dressing up as ghosts or witches became fashionable, though as the holiday became more widespread and more commercialized, and with the arrival of mass-manufactured costumes, the selection of disguises for kids and adults greatly expanded beyond monsters to include everything from superheroes to princesses to politicians. Before it was Halloween, October 31st was the pagan holiday of Samhain, the official end of summer and the harvest season. Ancient Celts believed that at Samhain, the veil between the worlds of the living and the dead was extremely thin, allowing the dead to cross over into the world of the living. Sometimes they appeared as apparitions and sometimes in the form of animals, most particularly black cats. The living lit bonfires and dressed in costumes to confuse the spirits and keep them from re-entering the world. When Christianity came to Ireland and Scotland, it simply co-opted the three-day festival of Samhain and folded it into All Hallows' Eve, October 31st, All Hallows' Day, which is All Saints' Day, November 1st, and All Souls' Day, November 2nd. It was a perfect fit, and the original pagan Samhain blended seamlessly into the new Christian celebration. In most of Christian Europe, the emphasis was and still is on All Saints' Day. But in Ireland and Scotland, because of the Celtic past and the legacy of Samhain, All Hallows' Eve, or Halloween, became the big deal, and various local traditions developed. In Ireland, children carved out potatoes or turnips as jack-o'-lanterns and lit them from the inside with candles. The practice originated from an Irish myth about a man nicknamed Stingy Jack who invited the devil to have a drink with him and then didn't want to pay for his drink. As the story goes, several centuries ago, among myriad towns and villages in Ireland, there lived a drunkard known as Stingy Jack. Jack was known throughout the land as a deceiver, manipulator, and otherwise dreg of society. On a fateful night, the devil overheard the tale of Jack's evil deeds and silver tongue. Unconvinced and envious of the rumors, the devil went to find out for himself whether or not Jack lived up to his vile reputation. Typical of Jack, he was drunk and wandering through the countryside at night when he came upon a body on his cobblestone path. The body, with an eerie grimace on its face, turned out to be Satan. Jack realized somberly this was his end. Satan had finally come to collect his malevolent soul. Jack made a last request. He asked Satan to let him drink ale before he departed to Hades. Finding no reason not to acquiesce the request, Satan took Jack to the local pub and supplied him with many alcoholic beverages. Upon quenching his thirst, Jack asked Satan to pay the tab on the ale, to Satan's surprise. Jack convinced Satan to metamorphose into a silver coin with which to pay the bartender, impressed upon by Jack's unyielding nefarious tactics. Shrewdly, Jack stuck the now transmogrified Satan coin into his pocket, which also contained a crucifix. The crucifix's presence kept Satan from escaping his form. This coerced Satan to agree to Jack's demand in exchange for Satan's freedom. He had to spare Jack's soul for 10 years. 10 years later, to the date when Jack originally struck his deal, he found himself once again in Satan's presence. Jack happened upon Satan in the same setting as before and seemingly accepted it was his time to go to Hades for good. As Satan prepared to take him to hell, Jack asked if he could have one apple to feed his starving belly. Foolishly, Satan once again agreed to his request. As Satan climbed up the branches of a nearby apple tree, Jack surrounded its base with crucifixes. Satan, frustrated at the fact that he had been yet again entrapped, demanded his release. As Jack did before, he made a demand that his soul never be taken by Satan into Hades. Satan agreed and was set free. Eventually, The drinking and unstable lifestyle took its toll on Jack. He died the way he lived. As Jack's soul prepared to enter heaven through the gates of St. Peter, he was stopped. Jack was told by God that because of his sinful lifestyle of deceitfulness and drinking, he was not allowed into heaven. The dreary Jack went before the gates of Hades and begged for commission into the underworld. Satan, however, fulfilling his obligation to Jack, could not take his soul. To warn others, he gave Jack an ember, marking him a denizen of the netherworld. From that day on until eternity's end, Jack is doomed to roam the world between the planes of good and evil, with only an ember inside a hollowed turnip. Turnip actually referring to a large rutabaga, to light his way. References to pumpkins date back many centuries. The name pumpkin originated from the Greek word for large melon, which is pepon. Pepon was changed by the French into pompon. The English changed pompon to pompion. Shakespeare referred to the pompion in his Merry Wives of Windsor. American colonists changed pompion into pumpkin. The pumpkin is referred to in The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, Peter Peter Pumpkin Eater, and Cinderella. Native Americans dried strips of pumpkin and wove them into mats. They also roasted long strips of pumpkin on the open fire and ate them. The origins of pumpkin pie occurred when the colonists sliced off the pumpkin top, removed the seeds, and filled the insides with milk, spices, and honey. The pumpkin was then baked in hot ashes. It's a story that came to America with hundreds of thousands of Irish immigrants in the mid-19th century. In America, pumpkins were cheaper and more readily available than turnips, but carving them and making them into jack-o'-lanterns lit by a candle inside became an American tradition as Halloween was enthusiastically adopted in the New World by people from every possible ethnic background. By the 1880s, it had really caught on and had become part of the tapestry of American holiday traditions. Today, most think of Halloween as an American holiday and are unaware of the ancient Old World roots of the carved pumpkins that are a traditional part of the celebration. So now you know why we carve pumpkins at Halloween. It's all because of the ancient Celts, pagans, and Irish descendants who came to America. Pagans today still celebrate Samhain. A fearsome being of fairy tale and myth, the witch has carved out a home in nearly every culture across the world and time. Indeed, the witch represents the dark side of the female presence. She has power that cannot be controlled. While this time of year brings about depictions of aging, ugly, hook-nosed women surrounding their cauldrons and inflicting toil and trouble on the masses, history tells us that the witch's origins are far less sinister. In fact, those whom we consider to be witches have often been healers. Carol Fontaine, an internationally recognized American biblical scholar, argues in an interview that the idea of the witch has been around as long as humanity has tried to deal with disease and avert disaster. In the earliest centuries of human civilization, witches were the women who served the goddesses and therefore were revered throughout their communities. In the Middle East, ancient civilizations not only worshipped powerful female deities, but it was often women who practiced the holiest of rituals. Trained in the sacred arts, these priestesses became known as wise women and may have been some of the earliest manifestations of what we now recognize as the witch. These wise women made house calls, delivered babies, dealt with infertility, and cured impotence. According to Fontaine, what's interesting about them is that they are so clearly understood to be positive figures in their society. No king could be without their counsel. No army could recover from a defeat without their ritual activity. No baby could be born without their presence. So how did the benevolent image of a wise woman transform into the malevolent figure of the witch we know today? Some scholars maintain that the answer might be linked to events long before the birth of Christ, when Indo-Europeans expanded westward, bringing with them a warrior culture that valued aggression and male gods of war, which dominated the once revered female deities. Others believe that when the Hebrews settled in Canaan 1300 BC, their male-centric and monotheistic view of creation came along for the ride. Obeying laws of the Bible, Hebrews believed witchcraft to be dangerous and prohibited it as a pagan practice. Centuries later, this fear of witches spread to Europe. In the 1300s, when the plague decimated Europe and killed one in three people, it also brought with it hysteria. Amid the panic, many attributed their misfortune to the devil himself and his supposed worshippers. At this point, the Catholic Church's Inquisition, which had already been established for decades, expanded its efforts to seek out and punish the non-Catholic causes of the mass deaths, including devil-doting witches. These women were believed to worship in large nocturnal assemblies, where various social skills were performed, such as promiscuous sex, naked dancing, and gluttonous feasting on the flesh of human infants. At the climax of this festival, people at the time believed that the devil himself would appear and participate in an unbridled orgy with all attendants. In order to save the church and its followers from the devil, then, these women had to be tamed. It is with that in mind that Catholic Church inquisitors Jacob Springer and Henrik Kramer wrote the Malleus Maleficarum, a book which assisted witch hunters in the gruesome task of diagnosing and punishing so-called witches, who as women were sexually vulnerable and therefore easy prey for the devil. "What else is a woman but a foe to friendship?" wrote the monks. "They are evil, lecherous, vain, and lustful. All witchcraft comes from carnal lust, which is, in women, insatiable." The manual's vivid descriptions would serve as a platform for zealous witch hunters to act on their prejudices for over 200 years. At the time, Malleus Maleficarum was second to the Bible in terms of popularity. Fontaine notes that while there had been witch-hunting manuals prior to the publication of Malleus Maleficarum, these two monks were the first to associate a specific gender with witchcraft. By the end of the 1600s, the witch-hunting hysteria in Europe reached its peak. Witch hunts spread like wildfire across Europe, the worst of which occurred in France and Germany. Würzburg, Germany, was home to the worst instance of witch hunting. The magistrates at the time determined that most of the town was possessed by the devil and condemned hundreds to death. Religion professor Barbara McGraw notes in a 1996 interview that there were some towns in Germany where there were no women left. Thousands were arrested and brought to inquisitors for examination. Under an inquisitor's brutal scrutiny, the accused were stripped and searched. Any suspicious wart, mole, or birthmark could be enough to receive a death sentence. In order to execute the accused, however, they first needed to confess. Torture seemed to be the best way of inciting confession, and the church would use instruments such as thumb and leg screws, head clamps, and the Iron Maiden to generate the truth needed to enact death. While torturing women under examination, the Malleus Maleficarum warned the torturer not to make eye contact with her, as her evil powers might cause the torturer to develop feelings of compassion. When this period ended, at approximately the beginning of the 18th century, an estimated 60,000 people in Europe had been killed as witches. Overseas, the most anthologized witch hunt took place in Salem, Massachusetts. The 17th century settlement had a rough beginning, decades of Indian wars, land disputes, deep religious divisions, and a tendency to look to the supernatural to explain the unknown helped set the grounds for this particularly New World brand of hysteria. The witch hysteria in Salem began in 1692 in the home of a Puritan minister named Samuel Parris. Parris was deeply concerned about a game that his daughter Elizabeth and niece Abigail had played, in which the two girls looked into a primitive crystal ball and saw a coffin. This vision sent them into convulsions, and within a few days, nine other girls throughout the community were stricken with the same ailment. Under the pressure of Parris, The girls then named three witches who may have cursed them: Tituba, their household slave, Sarah Good, a beggar woman, and Sarah Osborne, a widow rumored to have had an illicit affair with one of her servants. All three women were social outcasts, and thus easy targets for suspicion. The 1692 Salem witch trials spread witch-hunting hysteria to 24 outlying villages. That year, jails were crowded with more than 200 accused witches, 27 of whom were found guilty, 19 of which were killed. The trials met a swift end, however, in part because supposed victims began pointing their fingers at high-ranking figures within the community. When the wife of the governor of Massachusetts was accused of witchcraft, leaders saw to it that the trials ceased immediately. As to what spurred the girls' confessions, Fontaine attributes them to a form of social release. The girls had been so tightly controlled in Salem that this confession allowed the girls to receive some kind of attention. Hundreds of years later, the fearsome image of the witch faded and was absorbed by a popular culture who used the witch's violent history as costume inspiration. Others, however, used it as a means to found a new spiritual movement. In 1921, British archaeologist Margaret Murray penned a book called The Witch Cult in Western Europe, in which she argued that witchcraft had not been an obscure occult, but a dominant religious force. Though Murray's theories have been widely discredited since the book's publishing, her work sparked a fascination with witches that had been dormant for 300 years, eventually helping spawn the Wicca religion. The religion, which is named after an Anglo-Saxon term for craft of the wise, circles back to ancient practices that use herbs and other natural elements to promote healing, harmony, love, and wisdom, all following the tenet of harm none. It remains to be seen who the world's powerful will choose as their next witch. But as history has shown, the fearful is often the female. Considered one of the best horror movies of its day, and possibly of all time if you believe the numerous lists of horror movie rankings, The Changeling, starring George C. Scott, is a must-see ghost story of the silver screen. But what many don't know is that The Changeling is based on real events. That's up next on Weird Darkness. This month, October 2020, is the 5th anniversary of Weird Darkness. Hard to believe I've been doing this now for 5 years. Well, I'm using this 5th birthday as a milestone to raise funds to battle depression and suicide, and I need your help to reach our goal. Since it is the year 2020, our goal is to raise at least $2,020. But the more we raise, the more help that we can provide to those who struggle with depression and dark thoughts, and the more awareness that we can bring to the issue as well. All money raised is being donated to the International Foundation for Research and Education on Depression, and a gift of any size is greatly appreciated. $5, $10, $100, whatever you can give. Maybe you'd like to give a monthly donation of $20. Maybe you've been particularly fortunate this year, and you can make a single donation of $500 or even $1,000. This is the last week of October, so it's the last week that I'm asking for donations. Please, while you're listening to this episode, visit darknesschallenge.com and click on the donate button. Please, give now. That's darknesschallenge.com. That's darknesschallenge.com. And thanks in advance for your generosity. Congratulations to this month's Weird Darkness newsletter winner, Courtney Doner. Every month, I randomly draw one name from all of the people who have subscribed to the newsletter, and Courtney is our October winner. Congratulations, Courtney. You win a free Weird Darkness t-shirt, coffee mug, and button. I'll choose another winner on the last Wednesday of next month, so if you haven't already signed up for the newsletter, get on it. If you've read any lists of favorite ghost films, you know that the 1980 classic The Changeling is always a highly recommended movie, especially at this time of year. In the film, George C. Scott plays a composer who loses his wife and child in a terrible car accident. Looking for a fresh start, he moves into an old house that he quickly discovers is haunted. Those who've seen the film will vividly recall its many chilling scenes, like the séance and an incident involving a red rubber ball, and you'll agree with me that it ranks as one of the best haunted house movies of all time. But what you might not know about The Changeling is that the story of an angry ghost haunting an old mansion is based on true events, or at least as true as most based-on-a-true-story horror films seem to be. In 1968, a composer named Russell Hunter moved from New York into the Henry Treat Rogers Mansion, which was located in a historic neighborhood near Cheeseman Park in Denver, Colorado. According to his account, he rented the sprawling old home for a mere $200 a month, because no one else wanted to live there. After only a few months, Hunter began noticing some strange things in the house. It started with a banging sound that he heard each morning, which stopped whenever he got out of bed. Doors opened and closed by themselves, faucets turned on and off, and sometimes pictures on the walls shook so violently that they flew off the walls. Looking for a source for the weird happenings, Hunter later stated that he discovered a hidden staircase in the back of an upstairs closet. It led to a small room that contained the belongings of a young boy, including a journal of his secret life. After reading through the journal and holding séances in the house, it was learned that the resident ghost was a sickly child who had once lived in the house and had been the heir to a fortune left to him by his grandmother. The boy died very young, and his parents were so worried that the inheritance might be passed on to another family member that they buried him in an unmarked grave in a field southeast of Denver. Soon after, they adopted a boy from an orphanage to pose as their child. He kept the secret, received the family fortune, and went on to great wealth and success. Hunter claimed that the ghost of the sickly boy directed him to the location of his unmarked grave, which was now beneath a house on South Dahlia Street in Denver. The spirit reportedly threatened the family living in the house if Hunter could not convince them to let him dig up the boy's body. The family agreed, and Hunter and some friends managed to unearth a set of human remains, along with a gold medallion that was inscribed with the dead child's name. The haunting should have been over at this point, but it wasn't. In fact, things got worse. The activity in the mansion became violent. Objects were thrown, a wall collapsed behind Hunter's bed, and one night a set of glass doors exploded, badly cutting him. Afraid for his life, he finally fled the house. He moved into a new place on Kearney Street, but the haunting followed him there. Eventually, a minister from the Epiphany Episcopal Church cleansed the house and the activity came to an end. Hunter's story, spoiler alert, is very close to the story told in the movie version of The Changeling. Even the red rubber ball makes an appearance in his account since it was the sickly boy's favorite toy. Over time, Hunter's story has been called into question. His ghostly claims were fact-checked, and no record was found that said that he ever lived in the Henry Treat Williams mansion, although he did reside in Denver in the late 1960s when he was helping his parents manage the Three Birches Lodge in Boulder. It's very possible, though, that his residence in the house was off the books, just as he claimed, for a low price because no one wanted to live in the house. There's also no record of the boy who supposedly haunted the house, but there are some curious facts about the family who built the mansion, including that they owned the farmland where the child's unmarked grave was said to be located. It's very unlikely that Hunter could have known this or had access to the records that proved this information when he lived in the mansion. It should also be noted that strange happenings and hauntings have been reported all over Denver's Cheeseman Park neighborhood for decades. It may be because the park was originally a very large cemetery. As recently as the past few years, workmen who were digging in the park unearthed a number of skeletons. In fact, they turn up all the time. which reminds me of another good horror movie or two. She was a beautiful girl who decided to celebrate Halloween dressed as a bunny rabbit. Young Zhang Cindy Song was a 21-year-old Pennsylvania State University student originally from Seoul, South Korea. During the very early morning hours of November 1, 2001, Cindy was last seen at a Halloween party hosted by Players Nightclub, a popular bar in State College. She left the party at 2 a.m., Eyewitnesses said she was wearing pink shirt sleeves, rabbit ears, a white skirt, and a fluffy white tail above knee-high brown suede shoes. 2 hours later, one of Cindy's friends dropped her off at the State College Park Apartments located on the 300 block of West Clinton Avenue. All agreed that Cindy was likely drunk by this time. 3 days later, after Cindy did not contact any of her friends, they reported her missing. Police investigators discovered that Cindy was not at home and that very few of her items had been stolen or taken. Detectives noticed that only Cindy's keys and purse were missing from the apartment. A search of Cindy's cell did not uncover any outgoing or incoming calls during the 3 days after Halloween. Police also claimed that Cindy's apartment showed no signs of a struggle or a forced entry. 2 years later, a separate police investigation shed light on the possibility that Cindy may have been the victim of a serial killer. Just north of Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, police began excavating the property of Hugo Selensky, a man who authorities believed was responsible for the deaths of two drug dealers. Police did find the charred remains of these victims on Selensky's property, but they also found more bodies. In total, 12 bodies, many of which had been burned in a fire pit, were found on Selensky's property. Many believe that Cindy Song was one of these bodies, but police have not yet been able to prove this for sure. In 2003, Selensky was arrested for the original double homicide, but 3 years later, a jury refused to convict Selensky of homicide, but they did convict him of abusing the corpses. That same year, Selensky was charged with two other murders. These victims were Michael Kirkowski and Tammy Fassett, both of whom had been robbed and beaten before they were murdered. An accomplice, Paul Weekly, later admitted to helping Selensky in his double homicide. That year, while Selensky was rotting behind bars after being convicted of other crimes, he managed to escape from prison thanks to a rope fashioned out of bedsheets. He spent 3 days on the run before turning himself in. Over a decade later, Selensky was finally convicted of the murders of Kirkowski and Fassett. He received a life sentence. The disappearance of Cindy Song, however, remains unsolved. Horrifying tales of torture, decapitation, and murder, and those are just the acts committed by the accusers. The Salem witch trials of 1692 remain among the most infamous episodes in all of American history. But across the sea, in Europe, hundreds of years prior, similar events took place, this time involving persons accused of lycanthropy, or shape-shifting into werewolves. According to Mental Floss, the first recorded instance of anyone being accused and convicted of lycanthropy occurred in Poligny, France, in 1521. As the story goes, a supposed wolf attack led authorities to the home of Michael Verdun, who, after being arrested and tortured, confessed to being a werewolf, along with two other men, Pierre Bourgault and Philibert Montot. Bourgault also confessed and told authorities of a deal made with three men dressed in black who agreed to protect his sheep in exchange for the rejection of his belief in God. He was given an ointment that allowed them to shapeshift into wolves, during which time they would stalk the land, killing and eating children. All three men were found guilty and were executed shortly thereafter. The accounts of lycanthropy that follow that first one are eerily similar in detail, many of them involving ointments and deals struck with otherworldly characters. The 1598 case of Frenchman Jacques Roulet, also known as the Werewolf of Caude, involved the use of a transformational salve, which Roulet used to murder and then eat several young children. Although he was sentenced to death for his crimes, a conviction of feeble-mindedness instead sent him to an asylum where he received a religious education before being released just 2 years later. The fate of Peter Stubb, a German man, was not so fortunate. After flat-out confessing to having made a deal with the devil, in which Stubb was gifted a belt allowing him to shapeshift for the sake of killing and consuming countless victims over 25 years, he was publicly executed in 1589 in a most gruesome way, having his skin ripped away, arms and legs broken, and head removed before being burned. Following that, a man named Folkert Dirks claimed during the Amersfoort-Ock Utrecht trials in the Netherlands that he and his family were able to shapeshift into wolves and cats under Satan's command, as did Conti Hans and his spouse, who admitted to possessing the ability to turn into bears under Satan's command, though only after being tortured. Along with supposed deals with the devil, cannibalism is another recurring theme among all these lycanthropy cases, including the 1573 execution of Frenchman Gilles Gardner, who was accused of killing and cannibalizing children who ventured into his neck of the woods and later confessed to being a werewolf. As many of these confessions of lycanthropy from Gardner and others only came later, long after the alleged incidents took place, most believe them to be either coerced through the use of torture or attributable to the suspect's mental illness or low IQ, prohibiting them from understanding exactly what they were confessing to. Whatever the case, the Christian people of Europe at the time were opposed to the peasantry's practice of paganism. Thus, many believe these werewolf trials to have been nothing more than a scapegoat for widespread fear concerning occult and non-Christian practices, an example of the witch hunt mentality, much like the witch trials that would occur in America a century later. This brings us to the case of a teenage boy named Hans, who was tried during the werewolf trials in Estonia. With 18 trials accusing 18 men and 13 women of being werewolves over the years, the case of young Hans was perhaps the most famous. Only 18 years old when he was arrested in 1651 on charges of lycanthropy, Hans quickly confessed to the charges brought against him. Admitting to having hunted as a werewolf for 2 years, Hans told the court of a man in black who bit him shortly before the physical changes occurred. Many believed this man in black to be the devil, and this mention of satanic forces qualified the werewolf to be tried as a witch and thus sentenced to death. When asked by a judge whether he felt more like a man or an animal, Hans replied that he, probably not unlike most 18-year-olds, felt like a wild beast, and that the changes within him could be measured both physically and metaphysically. Despite there being no physical evidence of any murders committed by Hans, he was sentenced to death simply on the grounds that satanic magic had been performed upon him. While most of the accused never lived to see another day, not all werewolves were guaranteed a death sentence, such as 80-year-old Theus of Kaltenbrunn, claiming to be a hound of God. Theus stated that he used his werewolf cloak to enter hell 3 nights a year, where he battled devils and witches in order to ensure a good harvest for the next season. As he never admitted to having made a pact with a demon in exchange for lycanthropy, Theus was only convicted of practicing folk magic believed to encourage the rejection of God and was sentenced merely to a flogging, a much lighter punishment than so many of history's supposed werewolves once had to endure. Up next, Ouija boards. Innocent toy or dangerous tool? It depends on who you ask, but you'll never get me to mess around with one. We'll look at the history of the Ouija board and the possible dangers of using it when Weird Darkness returns. The third annual Weird Darkness Halloween live stream is this coming Saturday, October 31st, Halloween night. I'll be doing the podcast live via video on both Facebook and YouTube, or I've also set it up so you can watch it on the Weird Darkness website on the live stream page. In fact, videos from previous year's live streams are also posted on the page if you want to give them a look. I've watched them again, and well, they've inspired me to work extra hard this year to really up my game on quality, both visually and audibly. Join me this Saturday, Halloween night, as I tell true ghost stories, real tales of terror, and more, live on video. The live stream begins at 7 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Central, 10 p.m. Eastern, and for you weirdos on Greenwich Mean Time, November 1st at 2 a.m. If you want to watch it live, be sure that you have already liked the Weird Darkness Facebook page or you subscribed to the Marler House YouTube channel. If not, then just click over to the live stream page at WeirdDarkness.com and you can watch it there. Again, this Saturday, October 31st, Halloween night, the Weird Darkness Halloween live stream. The video podcast begins at 7 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Central, 10 p.m. Eastern, and 2 a.m. November 1st, Greenwich Mean Time. Before getting back to the podcast, a quick note of thanks to Brian for donating $50 to our Darkness Challenge fundraiser. Thank you very much for your donation, Brian. We have just under $500 still to go in order to make our goal before the end of the month, and we don't have much month left. If you know anybody who suffers from depression or thoughts of suicide, then you know how important this is. Please consider making a donation of any amount, and tell others about the Darkness Challenge too while you're at it. Visit darknesschallenge.com right now and click on the Donate button to make your financial gift of any size. $5, $10, maybe you can do the $500. Whatever you feel you're being led to give. That's darknesschallenge.com. Since the beginning of recorded time, man has claimed to be able to communicate with the spirit world. However, it would not be until the heyday of the spiritualist movement that he would begin claiming to do so as an everyday occurrence. That particular movement was founded by two girls, Kate and Maggie Fox, who established a way to communicate with a ghost. They used a series of knocks and raps that answered yes and no, and eventually assigned a code for letters of the alphabet. In this way, they were able to spell out longer and more detailed messages. As spiritualism grew in popularity, those with an interest began to establish what were called home circles, small groups of friends and family members who would gather around and attempt to communicate with spirits. They experimented with the knocking and rapping sounds and table tilting as a method of receiving yes and no from the spirit world. Soon, the tiresome and time-consuming method of knocking and tipping tables began to fall out of fashion, and so mediums began a new form of contact called automatic writing, which provided a direct line of contact with the spirits. It was believed these ghosts would guide the medium's hand and spell out messages for the sitters who were present. It soon replaced the slower methods of communication, and soon, mediums claimed to receive more complex messages from beyond. While automatic writing was being embraced by mediums, those who satisfied their curiosity about the spirit world in the home circles were also searching for a more efficient way to reach the other side than by rapping on tables. In 1853, a French spiritualist named M. Planchet, according to the stories anyway, it should be noted that Planchet in French translates to little plank, making the story a little dubious, he invented a device that could do much more than tap on the table. The planchette was a small, heart-shaped table with pencils attached to its legs. Those who used it claimed that it operated by spirit force, and ghosts wrote out messages from beyond. The invention was often used by the mediums as a more elaborate form of automatic writing, but it really didn't hold wide appeal for the general public. However, a short time later, another invention would come along that could be used by everyone. No experience was required. and no real psychic skills were needed. This new device would revolutionize the spiritualist movement and have an impact that still resounds today. The talking board was born. At the height of the spiritualist movement, a cabinet and coffin maker from Maryland named E.C. Reich created a new method of communicating with the dead. He devised a wooden lap tray with the letters of the alphabet arranged in two lines across the center of the board. Below these letters, he placed the numbers 1 through 10 and the words yes and no in each lower corner of the board. He used the planchette with his board but removed the pencil tips and placed wooden pegs on the bottom of it, making it free to move around the board. It was always believed that Reich named his board the Ouija because the name represents the French and German words for yes, oui and ja. But this was not the case. He believed that the word Ouija was the Egyptian word for luck. Needless to say, it's not, but since he claimed to receive the word from a spirit on the board, the name stuck. But Reich was more interested in spirits than making money, and he sold the invention to his friend Charles Kennard, who soon founded the Kennard Novelty Company with borrowed money and began producing the first commercial Ouija boards around 1886. The first patent for a talking board was filed on May 28, 1890, and listed Charles Kennard and William H. A. Maupin, both of Baltimore, as the assignees. The patent did not claim to know how the board worked. It simply stated that it did. No effort was even made to describe how the board worked in any of its advertising material, making it seem even more mysterious and mystical. The less said about the how and the more about the supposed results ensured that the board was imbued with spiritual powers. Shortly after the company started, the shop manager, William Fuld, decided to go into business for himself. He forced Kennard out of the business and changed the name to the Ouija Novelty Company, and he began producing the Fuld's talking board in record numbers and became a successful businessman. He was a member of the Baltimore General Assembly in later life and remained in control of the company for the next 35 years. Fuld died in a freak accident in 1927. He was on the roof of a new factory supervising the erection of a flagpole when the metal support that he was holding onto failed and he fell from the roof, breaking several ribs. An ambulance was called to rush him to the hospital, but on the way, the ambulance lurched over a bump in the road, which caused one of the broken ribs to pierce Fuld's heart, killing him instantly. Opponents to the Ouija board have long used Fuld's death to give the board an eerie taint. The Ouija board was anything but a curse to Fuld's company, though. It became the most successful talking board manufacturer of all time, selling millions of boards as well as other toys and games. Fuld had created a new industry with the Ouija board, which he claimed to have invented himself. He started the apocryphal tales of the naming of the board, using Oui and Je, and claiming many of his successful sales plans came from the board itself. His heirs maintained the company until 1966, when they sold out to Parker Brothers. This company, also known for their success with toys and especially board games, produced not only reproductions of the Fuld board, but also made a deluxe wooden edition of the board for a time. Today, they hold all the patents and trademarks to the board, and they still produce it in large numbers. It's sold in novelty in toy stores today, but remains a near duplicate of the board embraced by spiritualists in the 19th century. A talking board, or Ouija board if you prefer, is perhaps the most controversial method of spirit communication imaginable, mostly because it can be used by anyone and requires no special powers to navigate. The board has been both condemned and praised in equal amounts as either a direct link to the dark side or a way to communicate with the other side. But how does it work? Most scientists will tell you that the messages spelled out on a Ouija board are nothing more than the unconscious movements made by the people touching the pointer. If this is true, then the board is operating by nothing more than the power of suggestion. Others maintain, though, that there is a psychic element to it. The board is powered by energy from the human mind, spelling out accurate answers using precognition, telepathy, or unknowing communication with actual spirits. It's either a channel for psychic manipulation or a telephone link to the spirit world. You choose. But then, there are those who say with conviction that it's a lot simpler than that. a Ouija board is a direct line to the spirits. Planchettes, they say, are moved by the direct force of the spirits, guiding the hands of the sitters. The spiritualists believed this, as do some ghost hunters today, feeling that the Ouija is an important tool in spirit contact, both good and bad. And this brings us to the reputation of the Ouija, which has become pretty bad over the years, especially among religious groups and the gullible. They often cite the overwrought and usually unsubstantiated cases of so-called spirit possession that occur after people use the Ouija. They say that malevolent forces, posing as friendly spirits, possess bored users, causing emotional damage, insanity, and even suicide. Cue the spooky music. If all that sounds like the plot of a cheap horror movie, well, it is. Such tales are urban legends, friend-of-a-friend stories that are told because they happen to a friend of mine's cousin's next-door neighbor. Most of the stories about the dire effects of Ouija board use have their roots in old newspaper stories printed around Halloween or in religious propaganda tracts of the 1960s. Can using a Ouija board be dangerous? Sure it can. It's possible for someone to become dependent or obsessed with anything, like religion, for instance. I like to think that you, my weirdos, are smart, so I'll let you decide for yourself if you want to put a Ouija board to use, whether you choose to believe that the board is a means of communicating with the dead, or, as scientists will tell you, the planchette is moved by involuntary movements of the fingers of the people holding it, that's up to you to decide. The Ouija board's going to continue to be produced and will continue to fascinate either way, and terrify some people for many years to come. As for me, I'm going to steer clear of it. Here in the Chamber of Comments, I answer your emails, comments, podcast reviews, letters I get in the mail, and more. You can find all of my contact information, postal address, and social media links on the contact page at WeirdDarkness.com. While you're there, you can join the very active Weird Darkness Weirdos Facebook group and hang out with me and the rest of our weirdo family. And you can drop me an email anytime at Darren@WeirdDarkness.com. Got an email from Carlos V saying, "Good morning, Darren. First of all, I want to say your show is what I've been looking for when it comes to horror, spooky podcasts. I listen to it mostly on my outdoor runs, especially when I run in forest trails. It's quite an experience, LOL. Anyway, thank you for all your work, man. Your stories are great. I've just heard the episode where you apologize for third-party podcast hosts and how they're putting in political ads in your show. That's messed up from their part, but let me tell you something, Darren. I could care less about that if it's you or not advertising these political commercials. I probably wouldn't even apologize, but again, we're living in different times, different generation. Well, that's all I wanted to say, Darren. Thank you for your work. You rock." Well, thanks, Carlos. Now, fortunately, most everybody has gotten the message now that all the political ads have nothing to do with my placing them. But I completely understand, though, how annoying they are, and I wish they would go away. What irks me even more is that these third-party apps that place those commercials, well, and any commercials actually, not just the political commercials, but I don't make any money on any commercials that these third-party apps place in my podcast. I don't get diddly squat from any of them. So it's kind of like a double slap to the face like that. I don't want the political commercials, and even if I do get them, I don't get paid for it. So you combine that with the daily texts that I get from all the political parties and candidates asking me to donate to their campaigns, and man, it's almost enough to make you want to move to a deserted island. You know, so long as that deserted island has high-speed internet, but still. Got an Apple Podcast review from Matt Crum. He said, "I'm going through all of the podcasts from the beginning, and I love the variety of different stories and topics for each show. The narrator does an excellent job at conveying the mood for each story, and using Midnight Syndicate as mood music makes each episode a treat to listen to." Well, thank you for the really nice review, Matt. Thank you. I don't use Midnight Syndicate on every episode, but I do agree that they are incredible and are perfect for setting a spooky mood whenever needed. In fact, if anybody is having a Halloween party or you just want spooky music in the background while you're greeting trick-or-treaters at the door, Midnight Syndicate is a great choice. In fact, there's a link to their music in the credits and sources section of the show notes in this episode, so you can find them on Amazon. And you can also get their dark Christmas music there too, which is awesome. Got an email from Cobalt Dreamer saying, "I don't use many apps that let me rate your show, but since I came upon your podcast, I am loving it, and I find these listeners commenting about how they think you make lots of money or don't like your voice. It's silly, and I know everyone gets comments like that, but it sucks. And I wanted to cheer you on. I don't have any qualms with the religious speak. Some people love and need that in their lives, and most are better for it. I like your voice, how supportive you are, and I'm going to listen to all the things. I missed out on the other podcast you had, but I'll go back and listen to them when they get dropped into this feed. What's your favorite horror or myth style? I appreciate your October goal to help those with depression. You don't have to read all that on the podcast." Oops. Sorry, too late. "Love your podcast. It's spooky enough and fun enough with some great tales and decent research that's not bogged down in certain ways like a few others. Highly doubt I'll ever bore of it. You rock." Signed, Cobalt Dreamer. Well, thank you for the encouragement and support, Cobalt Dreamer. I appreciate that. You know what? I feel all people need God, so that's why I talk about Him. But I try not to be forceful or disrespectful either, just sharing when I feel it's appropriate. "Now repent, or you'll go to hell." Sorry, no idea where that came from. The Church of the Undead is already in the Weird Darkness feed, though, if you want to look for it. I transferred the episodes over, but they're still on the dates that they were originally published. If you want to find them easily, though, just click on the Church of the Undead link at WeirdDarkness.com. I've given them their own kind of their own category, so you can just click on that and you'll only see those episodes. In answer to your question about my favorite horror or myth style, that's a toughie. I don't care for gore. It's boring to me. There's no actual storyline aside from setting up kill after kill. So slasher movies and torture stuff like that, like Saw, they're completely out. I don't like those at all. I will typically go with a psychological thriller or well-done ghost story, something that messes with your head while you watch it. Insidious was good at that. So was The Conjuring. Not truly scary, but certainly entertaining, and they pulled me into the story. The Babadook was really good at that too. Seven was intense. Another film that doesn't get the recognition I think it deserves is Fallen, starring Denzel Washington and John Goodman. I think there's like two other films out there with the same name of Fallen, so don't get confused on those. You're looking for the one that's starring Denzel Washington. Fallen. It's a great film, but nobody ever talks about it. On the flip side, though, I also like films that don't take themselves too seriously, like the anthology flick Trick or Treat, Tucker and Dale vs. Evil, the John Carpenter's Vampires is kind of fun, From Dusk Till Dawn, those were fun. But I also like horror action, and I think this is probably what I like the most because it's kind of brainless. Still not scary, but I'll watch the Underworld movies over and over, as well as the Blade films. They're just downright fun to watch. I got an email from Cresta saying, "Hi, Darren. I'm from Colorado Springs, Colorado. I just wanted to say thank you for your podcast. I look forward to listening to it every night. I'm a veteran and suffer from depression. Sometimes when life gets to be a little much, this podcast is often the little bump I need sometimes. Thank you," signed Cresta. Colorado Springs. You know, actually, that's one area that my bride and I have dreamt of moving to someday. Maybe, assuming I ever become independently wealthy, which I do not see happening in the near future, but hey, it's fun to dream. You know, I'm glad you found the podcast and that it gives you a little oomph when you're listening. It never ceases to amaze me that a dark podcast can lighten someone's spirits, but you know what? I'm glad that it does for those who need it. So thank you for your service and God bless you, Cresta. And I also received some really nice fan art this week. I don't receive it very often, but two people sent me some fan art this week. If you want to check it out, one piece came untitled, so I'm just going to call it Halloween Hellhound by Coates Zeller, Coates Zeller. Sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name. And then Mallory T. sent me three pieces of hers. I placed all of that, though, in the Weird Darkness blog, which you can find on the website. I'll answer more of your emails, comments, and letters next time. Again, you can find all of my social media and contact information on the contact page of the website. or you can drop me an email at darren@weirddarkness.com. Thanks for listening. If you like the podcast and you haven't already subscribed, be sure to do so now so you don't miss future episodes. And also, please, tell someone else about the podcast. Recommend Weird Darkness to your friends, family, and coworkers who love the paranormal, horror stories, or true crime like you do. Every time you share the podcast with someone new, it helps spread the word about the show, and a growing audience makes it possible for me to keep creating episodes as often as I do. Plus, telling others about Weird Darkness also helps get the word out about resources that are available for those who suffer from depression, so please, share the podcast with someone today. And again, this month I'm raising awareness and funds to battle depression, and I need your help. Please visit darknesschallenge.com to give as much as you can. And if you struggle with depression, consider making a video to help raise awareness. Get the details about the video challenge or make a donation, or do both, at darknesschallenge.com. Do you have a dark tale to tell of your own? Fact or fiction? Click on Tell Your Story on the website, and I might use it in a future episode. All stories in Weird Darkness are purported to be true unless stated otherwise. Weird Darkness theme by Alibi Music. Weird Darkness is a registered trademark. Copyright Weird Darkness 2020. And now that we're coming out of the dark, I'll leave you with a little light. Psalm 23, verse 4. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. And a final thought. The most beautiful things in the world cannot be seen or touched. They are felt with the heart. Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. I'm Darren Marlar. Thanks for joining me in the Weird Darkness.